morning. The Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection will come to order on Tuesday, February 15th, 2011. And we don't quite have a quorum yet, but I'll announce that when we do. But I wanted to get started with the bill. Right now we have two bills on our agenda. Senator Han will be leading us off this morning. And what I'd like to try to do is ballparkish, maybe 45 minutes apiece for each bill, and maybe a little give and take on there. We'll see how that goes. So we'll start off with Senator Han, if you'd like to come up and present your bill. Good morning, and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, members of the Commerce Committee. Thank you for having us here this morning and hearing the bill that we have.
Senator Han, I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment. We do have a quorum present now.
Thank you. Members, this is Senate File 32. We're calling it the Minnesota Healthy Contribution Program. And what I'd like to do is just take a few minutes and walk through the bill and explain a little bit what the bill does. It's a little bit complex, not excessively so, but just want people to understand what it is we're doing. And then I've asked John Tyler, who's here from the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, and there are some other people also that want to help in the explanation of what we're doing and why we're doing it. But this really represents a change in direction for health insurance for low-income Minnesotans. That's really what this is. It's moving us in a different direction than what we've seen under Minnesota Care. There are some trade-offs, and we'll talk about those as we get into the bill. But let me just walk through a little bit what's in the bill. The first section, what it does is specifies that a person who's eligible for this program may enroll in MCHA with a waiver of pre-existing condition limitation if they've been denied coverage in the individual market. Section 2 requires the commissioner to modify the Minnesota Healthcare Programs to form to ask applicants if they are U.S. military veterans. The Section 3 is the sort of the heart of the bill that establishes the program. And what this does, Subdivision 1, Paragraph A, requires that the commissioner, beginning January 1st of 2012, provide Minnesota Care enrollees who are adults without children with gross family income equal to or greater than 133% of federal poverty guideline. And then also families with children, assuming we get a waiver, if we have to get federal approval, with the same 133% income, that they would be provided with a monthly defined contribution in order to purchase health coverage through a health plan in the private insurance market. So what we're doing is we're saying, look, if you qualify, if you're a low income, and as the bill stands without the federal waiver, it would just be single adults without children. If you're at 133% of the federal poverty guideline, instead of being enrolled in Minnesota Care, we as a state are going to provide you with a voucher or a grant or a contribution or a stipend or however you want to phrase it, that they will then use to take to the private marketplace to buy a private insurance product. That's essentially what it does. There are some other details that I won't get into the nitty-gritty of that, other than going down to Subdivision 3, Paragraph A, requires the commissioner to determine the defined contribution amount using a sliding scale under which the per-person defined contribution is a function of age and income, so that the monthly per-person base contribution ranges from $122.79 for persons under the age of 21 up to $357.19 for persons over 60, age 60 and over. This then is multiplied by a percentage inversely related to income ranging from 150 to 80% to obtain a per-person defined contribution. So if you're at 133%, that base contribution is multiplied by 150%. And it talks about that specifically in, where is that? 3.1. Line 2.31 on the bill. So if you are at an income of 175%, then you get exactly the contribution amount. If you are at 250% of the federal poverty guideline, then you get 80%. So there is a sliding scale. So the lower, the closer you are to that 133, you get the contribution times 150%. And then you see on starting on 3.1, of that paragraph, it gives you a table that shows the base amounts by age. Paragraph B multiplies its contribution by 120, 1.20, for enrollees who are denied coverage under an individual health plan and need to go to the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. So, again, if you are going to the private market and you're going to purchase insurance, you are going to be underwritten, and you may find that you will be denied coverage. In that case, that person would then get an increase in their stipend to go to the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association to buy the guaranteed issue coverage that exists in Minnesota. We also have paragraph C, another, this was put in our committee when it went through the health committee, is to, in effect, recognize that we want individuals to make sure that they have some buy-in to this, so that the amount that we provide will only equal 90% of the plan premium. In other words, we're going to assume that everyone is going to pay at least 10% of the premium that they purchase. We want to make sure that individuals are recognizing that they have some contribution to this plan. I think other than that, there's some language on 4.8 asking the commissioner to seek federal waiver to allow us to include families with children. We don't know what that will do, and we are not confident that that will happen, at least in the short term. And in fact, the fiscal note reflects the opinion that it will not happen. And I think that's the pertinent parts of the bill that would be useful for the committee to take a look at. I'd like to ask John Tyler if he would be willing to do so, to walk through a little bit more and provide some further information on the structure of the plan.
Okay, Senator Hand, if you can just give me one moment, I want to make sure I don't overlook any procedural things, and I realized we didn't actually move your bill yet. So I think Senator Chamberlain is going to move the bill. So he's going to move that Senate File 32 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. Is that its correct destination, Senator Hand?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so that would be Senator Chamberlain's motion. And with that, then, go ahead. And Mr. Tyler, welcome to the committee. If you could please identify your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Tyler. I am actually a principal owner and Boys and Tyler Financial Group. I also am on the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, and I also serve on the board of the Minnesota Physician-Patient Alliance as well. My portion of this is to really explain or give you an introduction of the bill and its concept overall with regard to the sea change that is prospectively happening here with regard to ensuring lower-income Minnesota enrollees in Minnesota care, be the adults without children. We presently have a coverage level that has a defined benefit contribution amount that basically dictates when they see participating providers what level of coverage that they will have. Right now, that particular level of benefits does have an out-of-pocket maximum liability that, in all candor, is an unlimited potential maximum out-of-pocket liability to the enrollee. And I say that for two reasons. Number one, it has an exposure of 10% of the inpatient or of hospital services of the individual of the first $10,000 of benefits paid. After the $10,000 limit that of benefits paid, there is no more additional coverage right now. So there is at present a really extreme level of prospective liability placed on the individual when they are using Minnesota care, especially for hospital services, rather than in kind of insurance company situation. So what we are seeking to do here is to turn that around, to actually create an unlimited major medical maximum as far as insurance coverage is concerned, and replace that with a defined maximum out-of-pocket amount by providing them a little bit different scenario here, allowing them, as Senator Hand mentioned, a stipend, a reimbursement, a contribution towards the private sector that may be taken out to that private sector. And in some of the examples that you have before you here, the Medica Solo plan is an example of a plan. It is not the plan. It is an example of a plan that might be purchased with that particular stipend. That would be up to the individual and the agent of their choice to determine what amount or what kind of level of coverage they actually would purchase. But the objective with that, if you'll notice there, that the maximum out-of-pocket liability that they would have would be a $4,000 maximum out-of-pocket liability, which would include a $3,000 deductible after three copays for office visits, full preventive services, and first dollar prescription drug benefit. So we're exchanging an unlimited major medical maximum with a $4,000 or a prospective $4,000 maximum out-of-pocket liability. If an individual wishes to purchase richer coverage, they may do so on the open market. This is simply an example of what may be purchased, you know, right now. So rather than a bankruptcy waiting to happen, and rather than burdening our healthcare professional community with uncollectible bills in the event of significant claims, we're really turning that around and replacing it with a defined out-of-pocket maximum liability and unlimited major medical maximum as well. So that's one of the sea changes that is actually going on here. That's really very, very relevant. The other dimension of this is our objective is to provide our healthcare professionals commercial rates as far as reimbursements are concerned. What that essentially means is rates paid by commercial carriers rather than rates paid by the medical assistance or Minnesota Care required amounts of providers that will see Minnesota Care patients. That is a dramatic enhancement over what they're receiving right now. One of the big problems we have in the marketplace right now is called cost shifting from the public sector to the private sector, which means that's one of the things that pushes premiums up and the cost of healthcare up for the private sector, not on public plans. Our goal is to basically create a level playing field for the healthcare professionals so they really don't know or can't tell if they're seeing someone that's on a Minnesota Care plan or someone is on a regular private sector plan because the reimbursements are exactly the same. So the plan would be one that the individual would choose. They would determine what their out-of-pocket liability would be based on the plan that they would choose. But the reimbursement schedule that was chosen would show you basically what they could purchase without much or, if any, additional premium out-of-pocket liability they have. And they do have it right now. They do have a premium obligation right now towards the Minnesota Care plans that we are hoping to offset. But if they wish to use that towards a more enhanced level of coverage with a lower out-of-pocket, they are certainly free to do that. So the name of this routine is really basically freedom of choice of health insurance policy, and with the state really stepping back and saying, this is what we will provide you, and it's up to you to determine what you want that's best for you as far as your family, yourself or your families are concerned. And so we're trying to accomplish quite a number of things, but most significantly, we're trying to establish a plan that is affordable, that is a plan that can be continued, hopefully indefinitely, that really will salvage the Health Care Access Fund that is in danger of really going into the red in 2014, if not sooner, because of the drain on the Health Care Access Fund right now. So greater affordability, commercial rates to providers, limited out-of-pocket liability to the individuals, and an unlimited major medical maximum are what we're trying to achieve with Senate File 32.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Senator Hand, you have other testifiers?
Well, yes, I think we have a couple other people that wanted to make comments. I'd like to ask if Tim Wilkin, I think he's on the schedule, if he might be willing to come forward and make a few comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Tim Wilkin, representing the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. I'm just going to go through a brief PowerPoint to go over the bill. The objective is to, as Mr. Tyler indicated, to provide coverage in the private sector for the Minnesota Care population and to lessen the cost of the program to the state of Minnesota. And it does this by providing individual insurance policies for this population using the risk underwriting of the private sector. The higher risk individuals would end up in the MCHA pool. Just gonna skip through some of this. It also, for providers, it will provide a higher commercial rate rather than the lower rates that are typical of state programs.
Section by section.
And it will also have the benefit of having real insurance coverage versus the coverage provided under Minnesota Care right now has a $10,000 inpatient cap. So obviously the individuals covered under that program are not covered for a catastrophic type loss if they're in the hospital for any significant period of time at all. They'd hit the $10,000 cap and the rest would go either as debt or a write-off for the hospital. So that would benefit the hospitals by being able to tap into an unlimited policy limit. So it will also, since it's using a commercial rate that's typical of private policies, there will be less cost shifting onto the private sector, and therefore it helps support the jobs in the private sector at the hospitals and the different providers that are struggling with lower rates right now. Builds on the ability of I'm going to leave some of this off because it's it tends to be more in the human services area, but it addresses the MCHA by providing an extra high rate. For those who aren't familiar with MCHA, I don't know if you've had an overview of that yet this year. I'm getting nods that you have, but it makes MCHA whole so it doesn't shift extra costs onto the private sector and the MCHA surcharge that only the fully insured market pays. It also picks up that extra premium that is charged to an MCHA enrollee rather than that's above and beyond what the private market pays.
Is that it then, Mr. Wilkin?
Yes. Mr. Chair.
Right. Yep. Yes, we have a question. Senator Gazalka. Yeah.
Senator Hand or Mr. Wilkin, the Minnesota Care, the maximum that somebody can make and qualify for that, I see it's 250% of the federal poverty level, but what is that exactly? What's that number approximately?
Mr. Chairman, sorry, you're asking what is the dollar
income level for?
Well, I'd have to. I don't know if I have that written out. I can take
that varies on family size. Oh, thank you.
Okay. Ms. Abderholden has provided us with a chart. It depends on family size, but 250% of poverty, a family of four, that's $63,400 family income.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, the reason why I bring that up is, you know, that's not a ton of money, but that's certainly enough money that you can build and save resources. And so I see your point about the private care with the unlimited top end versus Minnesota Care with only $10,000. You could lose everything the way it's presently set up.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, you're right. What we're trying to recognize here, and we're not trying to hide this or that we're talking about a shifting or a trading of risks. Where is the risk and where is it going to fall? And what we're proposing under our structure is that there is significant and costly risk once you get past $10,000. If you're in the hospital, if you have something major happen to you right now under Minnesota Care, if you have a policy, you are not covered. You either have to look at debt or you have to look at bankruptcy or you have to look at having that become a liability on the system that is not going to be paid. What we are proposing is true insurance for that, and it's frankly it's an unlimited upper end, so that if a person does have a major medical, they have got coverage. The system is going to see the reimbursements that will help keep the costs from being shifted to other places. So we think that's of value. Now, what we're trading off, frankly, is that there is a limited and a defined exposure, out-of-pocket cost the individuals will bear. And it will be up to them to choose what level of that exposure they wish to assume based on what they can afford under the contribution that we offer in combination with other resources that they may want to spend. Right now, they are paying a premium to Minnesota Care for that coverage. We're assuming that they would likely use that to either fund a richer private market insurance plan or to use it for out-of-pocket costs, but it's up to them. So the idea is that they will enter into a plan structure that will have a defined maximum exposure out of pocket with an unlimited upside insurance against high cost unanticipated hospital expenses. That's the trade-off that we're offering with this bill.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. Then Senator Hand, I think
Mr. Chairman, I also wanted to ask if we have a testifier, I believe, from the Chamber of Commerce, and there is also a physician that would like to testify as well. And
who's ever ready would like to come up? And please identify yourself for the record. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lisa Bodine, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm about as new as several of you folks, and I haven't met everyone around the table, but I look forward to doing so. As you may know, the Minnesota Chamber represents 2,600 businesses across the state. 70% of those, approximately, are small businesses with less than 50 employees, many of them in your communities. The Minnesota Chamber supports exploring new models to restructure the state's health care programs. We know that it must be done to ensure sustainability of the programs into the future. And we specifically support programs that create a functioning and responsive marketplace and models that achieve better outcomes for Minnesotans, decreases the cost of health care, and also decreases the rate of future increases in costs. The chamber believes that Senator Hand's Senate File 32, the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Plan, is an approach to the sustainability, and we appreciate the Senator's initiative to explore these innovative ways to redesign health care programs throughout the state. We urge you to move this bill forward to finance, and if we can be supportive in any way in providing private sector input or information, we're happy to do so.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bodine. Senator Hand, your next testifier?
Mr. Chairman, we do have a physician. It's not the same physician that's on your list. And But he is a doctor.
Commissioners will allow that.
But, you know, and it's one of those doctors that actually helps people. You know, there are some doctors that never go ahead. That was a poor joke.
I'm one of those substitute providers.
Introduce yourself. Okay.
I'm Dr. Robert Geist. I practiced in St. Paul from 1960 to 1997.
Good morning, Dr. Geist. Maybe if you could, please spell your name for the record.
I was a urologist, practiced in St. Paul from 1960 to 1997, after which I acted as a consultant at the VA hospital for a few years. So I'm past president of the Ramsey Medical Society, past president of a whole bunch of other things. But let's get to the piece of paper. Do they have this?
I don't know if they spell your last name for the.
Yeah, so we just didn't have you on the agenda, so we want to make sure we get
G-E-I-S-T,
it
G-E-I-S-T, like poltergeist.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Geist.
I'm not going to exactly read this because it gives, I don't know if you have this handout, which is support of House or Senate File 32. And Dr. Ron.
Mr. Chairman, do the committee members have a copy of Dr. Geist's handout?
I don't know.
We do not. Do you have?
Well, we can get copies if you have someone who could.
I'll not read it. I'll speak to it. But it's a support of Senate File 32. Well, here's the real man. Do you want to read this, Ron, or do you want me to do it? let's get the official doctor here. Is that okay? This is a guy who really is still in practice. I usually fly and look at these things from 30,000 feet.
All right.
He's on the ground, okay?
Well, Dr. Geist, it's certainly a pleasure to meet you this morning. we appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say for the record, he supports my bill.
All right. So this must be Dr. Hanson then.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Dr. Hanson, if you could please introduce yourself and who you represent for the record, and then we go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. Good morning. Apologize for my lateness here. I had to drive quickly. I am Ronell Hanson. I am a board-certified private practice physician in diagnostic radiology. Currently, I'm actually staff at the Minneapolis VA. I was in private practice in Minnesota with St. Paul Radiology for almost 11 years. My specialization is in high technology applications and state-of-the-art medical imaging. I also lecture extensively on the cost effectiveness of medical technology and public policy to physicians, technologists, medical students, and pre-medical students. So I have a fairly large background in public policy discussions for many years. I'm immediate past president of the Twin Cities Medical Society. I sit on the Twin Cities Medical Society Public Policy Committee, the Executive Committee of the Minnesota Radiological Society, the MMA Committee for Health Reform Implementation, Twin Cities Medical Society Board of Directors Executive Committee. Mm-hmm. I'm an MMA member and annual delegate, and I've provided past testimony to legislative committees such as yours on a variety of issues, including sitting on the Legislative Committee for Pooled Exchanges in 07 and 08 with recommendations to the Health Reform Task Force. ACO constructs for Betty McCollum at her request and its implications to private practice and the financial ramifications of the ACA to private practices in the state of Minnesota. So today, I'm actually here to speak on behalf of Concepts Protecting the Patient-Physician Relationship, which is usually what I'm talking to folks about here. a lot of these concepts were discussed by the Minnesota Patient-Physician Alliance, where I'm also a member of the board. So I'm speaking as an individual, but I bring together an amalgamation of opinions that I get from a variety of public policy committees and my personal experience in treating patients. So my background is in care delivery, technology, and public policy. And the thing that I wish to bring to you today is the emphasis on the importance of the patient-physician relationship and how changes in public policy, which you folks create, can change the type of care patients receive, the access to that care, and the cost of that care. And a lot of times the unintended consequences of what we create is what seems to be a well-meaning policy are not well understood until we really get down to a more granular level. First and foremost, I think most of us practicing believe in creating public policy which works on a practical level to enhance the relations between the individual patients and the clinicians, and often this is lost in the formation of public policy. We frequently think about this in terms of dollars and cents, but we don't really translate this into how patients and physicians really go the day-to-day discourse of how they get medical care. And really that's where the most cost-effective and efficacious care takes place, is between clinicians and their patients. And this is often lost. And so what I'm here to talk about is support of any practical legislation which enhances that particular relationship. And as I said, it's frequently lost. In this particular case, I speak in favor of SF-32, and I'm speaking as an individual. I don't represent any one of these organizations for which I work or belong to, because it really puts the decision-making back in the hands of the patient and their physicians. Really, patients need to be able to determine what kind of care they want to receive, I think. And personal choice of physician and what kind of care they want to receive is frequently left out of the equation when we talk about healthcare reform. So what are three current trends that I see that are pretty concerning to me? One, of course, is increasing healthcare costs. I've been talking about this to legislative committees for a number of years. And particularly for those patients which are least able to afford it. I think SF-32 hopefully works to increase the affordability of healthcare services without breaking the bank for Minnesota, and we all know we're behind the eight ball by quite a bit here. Second trend, access to quality healthcare services. We need to make a clear distinction here between access of services and simply having an insurance card. I think there are a number of states which can demonstrate problems with this. When you provide people with Medicare or Medicaid-type insurance, which underpays providers, often less than the cost of providing the service, this is not really a sustainable or a realistic form of healthcare insurance. We like to think that it is because people have an insurance card, but you have to realize that businesses can't really stay in business, and medicine is a business, whether or not you're a big conglomerate or a private practice. You can't really stay in business delivering care that's not even completely paid for. And this is something that's often lost in the policy folks as well. The fact that we're basically reimbursing care at far below the cost of delivering it. Third, I've talked to the Health Reform Committee about this before. You know, Minnesota, if we continue on this path, is really becoming an unfriendly place for physicians to practice medicine. And we like to think that we're the best and the brightest, and we have Mayo, and we're frequently referred to a national healthcare policy. But as the place becomes a less and less friendly place for physicians to want to live, you have to understand that some of my contemporaries, when I went to medical school, left medical school with almost $300,000 in debt. That's to most people real money, okay? And so it's great to say that we all have an oath, a Hippocratic oath, which we do, but, you know, at the end of the day, one has to at least be able to pay their bills. My wife is an anesthesia resident at the university. She tells me quite frankly, if she was not married to me, a practicing physician, she could not afford to live in the worst apartment in downtown Minneapolis because of her loans. And I think we have to have a recognition that once people have been in graduate school for 15 years, okay, and they're broke, and they own a house on their medical school debt, we have to be honest about how people are going to respond in a marketplace by what we choose to pay them or how difficult we make it for them to practice. As you well know, some states have such onerous malpractice laws for OBGYN, they have literally no OBGYN physicians. And we can't forget that those are real factors which impact how the quality of care and the access to care in the state go around. So it's my understanding from SF-32 that we're trying here to enhance the level of healthcare services available to low-income Minnesotans and deliver that in a more cost-effective and efficient manner. From a practical perspective, providing patients an insurance card in a vehicle such as an expanded Medicaid program with poor reimbursements, which do not cover the cost of care, will not guarantee patient access. And I think many astute physicians have come to committees here and told them that repeatedly, and it's something that you really need to remember. As I mentioned, there are several states which have tried this, and it doesn't work. Clinics which increase their reimbursement levels through SF32 will actually be able to keep their doors open. Why is this important? Well, particularly for low-income Minnesotans, it's critical to have services available. You know, we have safety net programs, and frequently low-income Minnesotans are some of the most difficult to treat and some of the most at-risk patients we have. If you put people into a financial funnel in which it is no longer economically feasible or sustainable to treat these patients, nobody's going to treat them because they can't afford it. It's not that they don't want to. It's that they cannot afford it. So hopefully in the end, SF32 will enable clinics to see a larger number of low-income patients, primarily because the reimbursement rates will be set at a sustainable level for the clinic. This is particularly important in greater Minnesota. You know, we always think of the metro area. But remember, there's a lot of medical care that's delivered in outstate. And if those clinics collapse, you know, where do those people get their care? I don't think any of us in medicine are suggesting that clinics receive disproportionately exorbitant reimbursement rates. I think many of us are arguing that rates that allow us to keep the lights on and the staff employed are relatively good, at which most of the rates aren't even approaching that. From my perspective in public policy, I think one of the most important part of this is having hopefully improved transparency in where our healthcare dollars are going from the state. We really want to know what services we're getting and what we're paying for those services, not only me as a physician, but me as a taxpayer and a state citizen. HF8 hopefully goes towards that, and this is a critical component of what we're going to do with our limited resources. I think that's about all I have. That's my message, and I'm happy to entertain any questions now that I've kind of caught my breath.
Sure. Are there any questions for Dr. Hansen and committee members? No? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Hansen. Appreciate your testimony. I have a couple questions for the author, and then also I know there's somebody else on the agenda that wanted to speak to the bill as well.
Yes.
But before I ask my questions, is there any other testimony, Senator Hand, that you have in support of your bill that you're aware of?
Mr. Chairman, I not that I am aware of. I do have an amendment that I would like to offer in anticipation of Ms. Averholden's testimony. I've discussed this with her, but I would like to do that before her testimony, possible. So, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Right. Okay, Senator Hand, I just have two questions for you. The section that I'm, or the subdivision that I'm concerned about here is the MCHA, or the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association piece, because that's really where this overlaps with our community jurisdiction. And of course, that's the high-risk pool. And there will be some folks in this transition. If they can't make that transition, they're going to be enrolled in MCHA in accordance with our current statutes. And in the bill, you talk about the difference between revenue and covered losses would be covered by the Healthcare Access Fund. Do you have any idea on the numbers of projected enrollees, first of all, that would be moved to MCHA? And then has there been any thought into what losses might have to be covered by the Healthcare Access Fund? Do you have any information on that? Essentially, I'm trying to get at what will be the impact on MCHA for the bill?
Mr. Chairman and members, I hope you have the fiscal note that was prepared on the bill. Does talk about that. I believe that the assumptions that the department was making for purposes of the fiscal note, I think they were assuming that about 20% of the people that would apply would not be successful in being underwritten, would end up in the MCHA structure.
3,000, then?
Pardon me?
32%.
Mr. Tyler is saying that he thinks the fiscal note is assuming 32%. I'm trying to find in the fiscal note where it says that.
Page 7 of 10.
Let's see, where do I have that here? Yes, I think on page 5 of the fiscal note, it talks about that the average monthly enrollment in MCHA growing up to 33%. And so the fiscal note has that as an assumption. So there is an increased enrollment into the MCHA structure, but there's also increased contributions as people who are participating in private insurance plans will also be participating in the funding of the MCHA structure. And all those things are factored into the fiscal note that does show, after the program is established, about a 42, 48, I guess, in fiscal year 15, $48 million saving to the state.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, and now I think what we can do, if there's no other questions immediately from committee members, you mentioned you have an amendment. The A14 amendment was handed out, and I believe Senator Chamberlain is offering the A14 amendment. So Senator Chamberlain, move that. And do you want to explain your memo? Would you like Senator Hand to explain the impact of this on what he's doing with his bill?
I'll defer to Senator Hand. He's doing a good job.
Thank you.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Chamberlain. This is an amendment that came out of, after we talked about this bill in the Health and Human Services Committee, and Ms. Aberholden testified, and she testified in opposition to the bill. And one of the concerns that she raised is the concern about mental health coverage, that there was a concern that people under this program may purchase a health plan that does not require or does not provide for mental health services. Now, we believe that that's not a strong possibility, but we have a difference of opinion on this. And I just, the reason I handed out, and you see in your packet, there are some examples, and these are just examples of a couple of policies. One is a Medica Solo, and one is a Medica Encore plan. And the reason I wanted to show you that is to show you that the premium amounts are certainly affordable under the sliding scale, and that the premium amounts, if you choose not to buy mental health or chemical dependency, are lower. And so the point is that we believe that we've got a sufficient reimbursement that a person who wants to maximize getting the reimbursement from the state is going to buy a policy that has mental health coverage in it. There is an incentive to do it, we believe. The amendment is actually offering a little stronger incentive. And what it does is simply say that if the enrollee chooses to buy a policy that does not have mental health and chemical dependency treatment services, then the amount of the reimbursement from the state would be decreased by 5%. So in other words, if your incentive in being a part of this program is to maximize the contribution, the support from the state, then you will buy a policy that has mental health coverage in it. We believe that there's a strong enough incentive in the structure of the plans anyway, but this is just an added incentive to make sure to do the best we can that people who take advantage of these plans or this program will buy coverage that has mental health services in it. Now, again, this goes back to one of the differences in what we have under Minnesota Care and what this plan represents. Minnesota Care is a defined benefit structure. It says here are the things that you will receive, the defined benefits. What we're saying is we're giving people the freedom to choose the benefits that they wish, given what's available in the marketplace. What that means is that we can't guarantee that everybody will buy a plan that has mental health services in it. But we want to try to put everything we can to incentivize people who participate in this plan to do so. We think it makes sense. We think the differences in cost are very not substantial and certainly able to be covered with the plan that we've proposed. So that's what the amendment is trying to do, is to provide a further incentive for people who participate in this plan to buy a policy that has mental health services covered.
Yes, Senator Bonoff, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hand, I came in late, so I apologize that I missed part of the explanation. Are we funding these premiums out of the healthcare access fund still using the provider tax, or what happens to that?
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, the premiums, what we're doing is we're funding a stipend that is going to designed to cover a portion of the premium. And I don't believe that we say that those have to be paid for out of the healthcare access fund. The healthcare access fund is funding. I'm looking for the language here to see where it says that. John, do you know if it? Where in the language it says that?
I'm not sure that there's language in the bill. I think it is presumed that because this is Minnesota Care, it's funded by the healthcare
right. access fund. Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, we don't specify that in the bill, but there's a presumption that because Minnesota Care is funded out of the healthcare access fund, that this would be as well. But it's not specified in the bill.
So Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, so we're changing, so we're continuing Minnesota Care with the 2% provider tax, but we're unraveling it as a state program, and instead using those funds to give direct subsidies to the the people who get the insurance so that then they buy it on the private market. And then, Mr. Chair, so follow up. So the provider tax will stay at 2% in your plan?
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, the fiscal note, and I should have referred to that. If you look at the front of the note, it does talk about the health care access fund and the effect on that. What we're doing is saying because of the federal constraints, there's only a portion of the people under current Minnesota care who would be eligible for this program without an additional federal waiver. It's about, I believe, 15,000. It's single adults without children. So Minnesota care would stay in place for people who would not qualify under this plan. And we've asked for the department to seek a waiver from the federal government, so it's potentially possible that the entire Minnesota care population would be moved over, but the fiscal note does not assume that because the fiscal note assumes we will not get a waiver. So what will happen if this bill passes is you will have Minnesota care as it exists today dealing with a certain portion of that population, and then the single adults without children would be eligible for this program. But the premiums or the contributions would be funded out of the health care access fund. At least that's the assumption in the fiscal note. We don't specify that in the bill, but that's the assumption.
Mr. Chair, follow on.
Well, Senator Bonhoff, we're actually on the A14 amendment.
Oh, sorry.
And so I wanted to, I shouldn't have allowed it to get too far off track there. But if you, do you want to continue this after we take care of the amendment then? Okay, remind me then we'll do that then. Okay, and Senator Hand, on the A14 amendment, what I wanted to ask is before we, since we're on that amendment and it was of concern to Sue Aberholden. Maybe she would like to speak to that now. It would be appropriate. Maybe she could replace Dr. Hansen at the table here and tell us her perspective on this particular amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Aberholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and we're a statewide grassroots organization dedicated to improving the lives of children and adults with mental illnesses and their families. And nearly 100% of our board and staff either have a mental illness or have a family member. So just kind of you understand we're not a provider organization. I've been working with Senator Hand, and I'm pleased with this amendment. We were concerned that if people chose a plan that did not cover mental health services, the state pays for it one way or another. Because if people aren't able to get the care, then they're either using county or state dollars because they're underinsured, basically underinsured, or they end up in our jails, our prisons, and our homeless shelters. And so since these are state dollars going to, you know, essentially purchase a health insurance plan, we want to make sure that people are really incentivized to actually make sure that mental health services are covered. You know, mental health parity doesn't enter into individual plans, and it doesn't require you to cover mental health anyway. So that's why you can purchase these kinds of plans that don't have coverage. And, you know, none of us can choose what illnesses we get. And one in four adults will develop a mental illness, every year, which is a huge number of people. And, again, if you don't get the services that you need, the state's going to end up paying one way or another. So I really appreciate this amendment and definitely support it.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions on the A14 amendment? No questions. Okay. Then, Senator Chamberlain, renews his motion to on the A14 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. And the motion does prevail. So the A14 amendment being adopted, then I don't know if there's any additional testimony you wanted to offer to the bill in general or if that covers your concerns.
Mr. Chairman, one other small issue, and that is we're still a little concerned about the high deductible for people who are right around 133 to 150% of poverty because it is it's not a lot of money. It's, you know, $16,000 to, you know, $20,000 a year. We do have quite a few people with mental illness who are actually on Minnesota care. If you think about it, if you're in your mid-20s, you're having your first psychotic episode, you don't really want to say to the Social Security Administration or, you know, the Department of Human Services that you will never work again. You know, that's a pretty hard thing to say in your 20s. And so we actually have folks who go on to Minnesota care. They may not be able to work full-time because of the stress exasperates people's symptoms, but they're on this program, and it keeps them well. I'm afraid that with most of the things that I looked on, you're really looking at a $2,800 or $3,000 deductible as kind of the, you know, what you could afford. And that's, you know, you get three visits, and then you have to hit your deductible before you get coverage. And so I'm just a little worried for people on that low end of their income that they could actually afford that, and we want to make sure that people actually, you know, go to the doctor, go to the psychologist, you know, wherever it is they need to go to stay well and working. So that, and Senator Hahn and I have talked about that, and, you know, there may be a way to maybe just move it up a little bit so that those folks maybe stay on Minnesota Care or provide a little higher subsidy so they can purchase a lower deductible. Okay. That's all I have.
Thank you. Okay. Then what we'll do is we're back on the bill, and I want to continue on. Senator Bonhoff, you had some questions for Senator Hahn, so go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hahn, when you presented the bill in Health and Human Services, did the department take a position on the bill? Did the other insurance providers take a position on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, the department, I don't believe, has taken any formal position on the bill. We had Mary Krinke there from the Hospital Association. She testified and provided us with a sort of a cautious or endorsement of the bill. Obviously this is a new proposal, but they were not opposed to it and would like to see it move forward. And I don't recall that we had any testifiers there from the insurance plans.
Okay. Other questions from members? Then let me ask if there's anybody in the audience that would like to take this opportunity to speak either in favor of or in opposition to Senate File 32. Anybody in the audience at all? Seeing none, then what we'll do is Senator Chamberlain is going to renew his motion that Senate File 32 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, just want to make one final comment. I appreciate the opportunity to have a hearing in your committee. Thank you for your consideration. I obviously would urge your support and passage of the bill. We do think this represents a significant shift. It is a limited trial, I suppose you could say. It involves 15,000 people, at least as it's structured as we see it today. We think that it does emphasize the ideas of trying to encourage a stronger patient-physician relationship. We think we're doing some things that will put the financing of healthcare on a stronger footing that is more sustainable going forward. We think this is a worthy direction to pursue, and we would appreciate your support.
Okay. Then Senator Chamberlain has moved the bill as amended. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The motion does prevail. Senate File 32 as amended is recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and committee members.
Okay. Does he want to sit here, or do you want to do it from there? Okay, I'm going to take this.
Oh, it's out. It was out at 10:30, but apparently the website's down, so all she could bring is the PowerPoint.
The website's down. Nice.
I would imagine a few people are hitting it. You're going to do it office amendment?
Yeah. Okay.
I've heard there's some interest.
No.
Members, the next item on the agenda is Senate File 167 with Senator Gerlach.
Trying some different stuff.
Senator Gerlach, proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. Committee members again. This is Senate File 167 dealing with broker price opinions. It's a real estate issue. And let me just, from a high altitude, explain what we're after. My voice is a little bit gone, but it'll be fine. And then we'll have some folks from the Realtors Association of Minnesota talk about some of the technical pieces of the bill and why they would like this to pass today. There is a fiscal note attached to it as it stands right now, and so this bill would be going to finance when it comes time to make that motion. So then, let
Senator
me.
Gerlach,
let me. Oh yes.
You want to move your?
Yeah. Why don't we do that now? We might as well. So yes, I'll move that Senate File 167 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee.
So Senator Gerlach has moved that Senate File 167 be recommended to pass and referred to Finance Committee. Do you have an author's amendment that you'd like to bring
up? I do, and you know what? Let's do that next, too. I have the A4 amendment, and it is a delete everything, so that's what we'll be working off of. So members should have the A4 amendment.
Everyone have that?
And I will go ahead and move the A4 delete everything amendment to the bill.
Senate file, or I'm sorry, Senator Gerlach moves the A4 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Nay. Motion carries.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Now, the bill is in the shape where we're going to start it today. So we're working off of the A4 delete everything amendment. And let me just tell you, this is what the problem we're trying to solve. I often ask that question. What is the problem you're trying to solve? And in the real estate market, when it comes to the price estimation or the evaluation of properties, it's very critical. Lenders base their lending decisions on these reports that are generated. Consumers make decisions about what they should list properties at. And all of those have different places in the strata of what's being done. So let me just say that the way you're familiar with many of you, if you're going to list your home, you go to a real estate a broker, an agent, and they will put together a package or a presentation for you to list your home, and they will do what's called a market analysis. A market analysis is not a legal term. It's just an industry term for them going into the MLS, or multiple listing service, which is the computer database that is used for realtors to with all of the information about the homes that are for sale, ones that are pending or have sold, and all of the different data about that. It pulls in data. They run comps or comparables. And then with that information, they're able to extrapolate what they believe your home may sell for, and it helps to determine what the list price would be. That is an informal market analysis that's done just in the normal course of business. Now, on the higher end of the spectrum, you have appraisals. Appraisals are much more formal. They have to be done by a licensed appraiser, and those are the reports that are an estimation of value where the lenders rely on that. And, of course, if lenders are relying on that, since we know that all of these things are federally – many of these things are federally insured through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the housing industry. I mean, we all have a vested interest in these appraisals being correct, and or as correct as they can be. And so those appraisals are what are used by lenders then to actually originate the loans and write those loans. So what are we talking about today then? We're talking about the middle part. We're talking about the fact that a lot of lenders have portfolios of a lot of foreclosed properties that they need to know what could I sell these for? What are these worth? And they have increasingly relied on salespeople, sales agents, brokers, to give them snapshots, quick snapshots of what could this sell for. Those are called broker price opinions. They're not at the same standard as an appraisal. They're very similar to that market analysis in many ways, but they're instead of being provided to a consumer, they're provided to a lender so that they can keep tabs on what their portfolio is worth, or an estimate of that, so that they can then make decisions. Well, the problem is that there's no real regulatory structure around BPOs or broker price opinions, and as such, we have a sort of a clash between appraisers and brokers about who can do those, how they can be used. Well, there has been some federal legislation in the Dodd-Frank bill that takes effect this July, and they have some definitions of broker price opinions, and we've relied on that. The Minnesota Association of Realtors has approached the Department of Commerce, which had been receiving complaints from folks about who can do these and who can't, and then of course there's enforcement issues there. So the problem we're trying to solve is to define these broker price opinions, put the structure around them. Who can do these? What can they be used for? And that's what this bill does. So that is the high altitude situation, and what we're going to be talking about today is some of the specifics about how we do that And then we'll be hearing some testimony from folks, from realtors, also maybe from the Bankers Association, from the lender community. And then also I will tell you up front that there is not peace in the valley on this bill. Appraisers are concerned and have disagreements over some pieces of this bill, and we can talk about those. I will tell you, as part of the process, when the realtors came to me with this legislation, it was drafted with the assistance of the Department of Commerce, but also the realtors had made some changes in all fairness and in what it came up with. It was based on, the department had based it on the Nevada law, which was based on a national model, because I had traced kind of where did this language all come from. And so that's sort of the genesis of where this came to. And then I had introduced the bill, and I didn't have any real feedback from appraisers at this point. But, of course, as you know, once you introduce a bill, that's how you find out and you learn from that. And so when I got a call from an appraiser, Ms. Wendy Walker from Walker Appraisals, then, and she expressed her concerns about this, I immediately had her called back and said, come on in, because I need you to tell me specifically where the shoe pinches on this bill here. And we had a good meeting. There was a list of items, and I was able to accommodate about half of those items, about five pieces, into the Delete Everything Amendment. It's not everything that appraisers wanted, but it is a piece of that. I've also accommodated another change that the Department of Commerce wanted with regards to records retention, and also there, I believe Senator Vanderveer will have some amendments offered today as well, and we'll be discussing those as we go. So that is the bill as it's laid out, and I think Mr. Paul Egger from the Minnesota Association of Realtors would like to talk a little bit about what his perspective is on this.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Paul Egger, Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And our association represents the roughly 18,000 realtors throughout Minnesota. I just want to thank Senator Gerlach for bringing this bill forward today. The Minnesota Association of Realtors strongly supports this legislation. And as Senator Gerlach stated, we spent quite a bit of time since last fall working on the language, and appreciate the Department of Commerce's suggestions along the way, and I'd like to just describe a few of the key elements of the legislation. Senator Gerlach did a great job of providing an overview, but let me just touch on a couple of items that in more detail. The bill does include federal conformity in a couple of key areas. And number one is, as Senator Gerlach mentioned, the definition of broker price opinion is actually the definition included in this bill is actually the definition from federal law that was that went into effect this past July in the Dodd-Frank legislation. So we take that definition and adopt it here in this legislation. There's also another portion of federal conformity in terms of when you may not use a BPO. And that language is found in this legislation as well, in the DE amendment, and was in the bill as introduced as well. And those are key components that we felt were important in bringing this legislation forward in Minnesota. A couple of other key elements. Senator Gerlach mentioned that there have been a number of changes along the way, both in terms of discussions between the Minnesota Association of Realtors and the Department of Commerce, as well as concerns brought forward by Ms. Walker and appraisers. And the legislation actually started out as a very brief couple of options that we provided the Department of Commerce last fall that were literally a paragraph or so. And we received feedback, and the bill grew in nature, and we think rightly so. The bill includes a number of key elements to provide more structure in terms of broker price opinions. And maybe just to take a step back, real estate licensees already do price opinions. As Senator Gerlach mentioned, any of you that have bought or sold a house, or we have many current and former licensees, you're very familiar with that process. You sit with a real estate or your realtor, your real estate licensee, and they maybe have a laptop and they flip it around and you take a look at comparable properties, and they help you determine a fair sale price for your home. Or conversely, if you're a buyer, they help you determine what an appropriate sale price is for properties that you're looking at. But price opinions have also been requested over the years by lenders. And in particular, as the market has changed in recent years and lenders have properties on their balance sheets that are either going into foreclosure or they're trying to preempt foreclosure by understanding, you know, what is the likely selling price of these assets, and can they advise the homeowner on what their options are moving forward. Price opinions have become a valuable option for lenders as well. And so with this legislation, we're really clarifying and that realtors have been and can continue to offer price opinions. We're also codifying that practice in statute with more detail than is contained in the statute as written. There was significant gray area in the statute as written, and so this legislation defines a BPO, defines who may do BPOs and for which purposes, and for which purposes you can't do a BPO. And back to the point of, you know, at the legislature, you're often faced with situations where there isn't peace in the valley, and as Senator Gerlach mentioned, this is one of those cases, and we just want to point out that certainly we're accepting things in this DE amendment that we hadn't proposed, but we want to accommodate as many concerns as we possibly can. It's important to note that in addition to the federal conformity, our members are also accepting additional regulation. There is a written report requirement when you're doing, which is a new regulatory requirement, when you're doing a BPO for a third party. And in addition, we accommodated a department request for ensuring that there's a record retention policy consistent with the retention of other records in a real estate transaction that applies to not only the BPO report, but also any supporting documentation. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I think that covers the highlights. We certainly, again, want to thank the chair for bringing the bill forward and be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Gerlach, do you have anybody else that you want to testify in favor of the bill?
I don't think so now, Mr. Chairman, but what we probably could do is take care of maybe Senator Vandeveer's. I know he's got several amendments, and if he wants to offer those, we can discuss those because those bring up a few points in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, if that's okay. First of all, is it your intent that appraisers be able to do BPOs?
Yeah, I'm sorry?
Is it your intent that appraisers be able to do BPOs?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Vandeveer, it is.
Thank you. And I appreciate your help on this. And we haven't got it perfectly worked out, but maybe we can get there. Thank you. The First Amendment just clarifies your intent, and that would be the A5 amendment.
Senator Vandeveer moves the A5 amendment. Does everybody have that?
No.
We hand out now.
And this is important because it's like if we can't do them, then it's like telling Ann Rest she can't do an easy 1040. So, we wouldn't want to do that, would we? Okay.
Yeah. Discussion? Senator Vandeveer, do you want to talk more about it?
This just simply includes appraisers as being able to do broker price opinions so that when they're in that market, they can offer that also.
Discussion?
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Gerlach.
One second, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Senator Vandeveer, I haven't had a chance to look at all of the page and lines on here, but we've talked about this, and it is the intent. In fact, as I explained in the overview, you have the brokers, and you have the appraisers, and then you have the middle ground. Well, the intent is to put the structure around so that brokers can offer these, but also we want to make sure that appraisers are well aware that they also are able to offer broker price opinions to lenders as well, and so this is the intent of the bill. And so I think that committee members should support Senator Vandeveer's A5 amendment.
A5
And Mr. Chair and Senator Gerlach, it is not a trick question. It's our intent with this, if it doesn't do that, is just that it simply includes real estate appraiser licensed in the bill.
Okay.
The trick question's coming.
For the discussion?
Okay.
Senator Vandiver again renews his motion to pass the A5 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Now, members, what we're doing here is substantially changing the standards for evaluating properties for refinance purpose. If it's not a sale, a point of sale loan, you're saying that broker price opinions can be used. And what that says then, instead of an appraisal, so what we're saying with that is we want to, since this is likely to be a hot item, because you remember the real estate agents are out there marketing or being marketed heavily by the loan officers who are also commissioned, like the real estate agents. So they're going to be out there offering this service to the people that are trying to get their business, because the most desirable thing to have is a loan originator is a good quality real estate agent that produces first mortgages. So they're going to be out there now being marketed by the real estate agents to do broker price opinions on the refinances. So we've just included real estate appraisers as now being able to do that. However, we want to make sure, because real estate appraisers, we license them to do valuations kind of like this for loan purposes. And these loans end up insured, as we all know, by us, and we have to. Our constituents are paying off a lot of mistaken loans already, just a few, I guess. But at any rate, I have the A5 amendment, which, I'm sorry, the next amendment is designed to exempt the real estate appraiser doing this from federal requirements by having the Commerce Department not enforce the rules that appraisers, you have to suspend the rules for appraisers. It's like in the legislature. We have to suspend the rules in order for them to do this because it is such a different standard, almost a non-existent standard. So I have the A8 amendment.
Senator Vandiver moves the A8 amendment. We'll wait till everybody has that.
And maybe Commerce could come up and address this amendment because they're the enforcement agency. Could Commerce come up, Mr. Chair, and address this amendment, because they're the enforcement agency, and just tell us how they think the A8 amendment would work? And what all the A8 amendment does is says a broker price opinion shall not be subject to USPAP, which is the governing rules, kind of like accountants have their rules. This suspends those rules and any new rules that the Appraisal Foundation, which is the national group that oversees this, which Minnesota appraisers are subject to.
Please state your name for the record.
Nice to meet you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just taking a look at the A8 amendment, and I thought you, based on your preliminary discussion, I thought you were going to offer a different one. But on this one here, we had talked about this, and if I could... I'm somewhat agnostic on this. I mean, I go either way on this in the opinion of the committee. What Senator Vandiver is trying to do is, correct me if I'm wrong, but appraisers, there's some question about whether appraisers can do BPOs. And what Senator Vandiver would like to do is make sure that we're very clear that they are allowed to do that without repercussions. And this amendment here is along those lines appraisers will be able to with additional language here. And the only thing maybe to be concerned about is, again, this is USPAP is the national organization which encompasses the code of ethics for appraisers and their procedures. And can we as a legislature exempt someone from this or whatnot from those standards? But I think that's why the department is here, to talk about their enforcement of this. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that, if this, your thought on this. But Senator Vandiver, maybe I don't want to put words in your mouth, but did I explain what you're trying to get at?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gerlach, yes, you did.
Okay,
thanks. But there was also an alternate amendment, which I can't find anymore. Maybe I could get that from the administrator. to.
Well, let's just maybe.
But you can go ahead and with this one.
Yeah, if you want to discuss the AAMA.
Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and Committee, my name is John Reich, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce.
My name is Tom Hack. I'm a senior investigator with the Department of Commerce.
Mr. Hack, could you just tell us, is the department think this is a workable amendment?
Mr. Hack?
I believe that it would not work. The Appraisal Foundation develops the federal guidelines, which are the minimum guidelines which appraisers need to follow. That book is called USPAP, or the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice. The appraiser can't ignore those federal rules. That's the minimum requirements which they must meet.
Mr. Hack, Mr. Chair, are those rules different than the ones that the BPOs are using?
Mr. Hack.
Yes, there are additional standards that must be met.
Thank you, Mr. Hack.
Discussion. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Vanderveer, we haven't addressed the beginning part of your comments, which I don't really see are related actually to the amendment, but in your beginning comments, you stated that one of the reasons that you had for putting forward this amendment was because you were concerned about the BPO becoming the basis for which refis and mortgages would be looked at. And I thought I saw in the actual bill that it says that's not the case. So I'm wondering if Senator Gerlach could address the beginning comments of what Senator Vanderveer said.
Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonoff, that's part of a larger discussion. Maybe we should save that. Maybe we should take care of this amendment here and then come back to that, because that whole how these things could be used, how BPOs can be used, is a larger question. It's a little different than the A8 amendment. And at that time, maybe what we could do is we could have some lenders come up here and talk about how they use BPOs, what's actually required by law, and how they're used in practice. And that might answer some of your question at that time.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Vanderveer, that's fine. It was just that's what Senator Vanderveer used as his rationale for the amendment, which concerned me.
Senator Vanderveer, to that point?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, that's because I was reading what the bill allowed them to use the BPOs for, and not what they're maybe what they're actually being used for or what they intend to use them for.
That's right.
Okay.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess probably to the Commerce Department, because the way I'm reading this A8 amendment specifically states the broker price opinion, unless UPAP USPAP is specifically dealing with anything with the broker price opinion, then this should be workable, because you're kind of taking off part of your appraiser hat to be able to be allowed to do a broker price opinion. It is not subject to all the different rules that an appraisal is subject to, and therefore, unless the federal guidelines would not allow for this, when the new federal guidelines go into effect, this seems perfectly logical to me, because a broker price opinion is far removed from a full-blown appraisal.
Mr. Hack.
As an appraiser licensed under these federal regulations, they have to abide by these minimum requirements. I think that in order to provide any additional opinion on that, we'd have to consult with the Appraisal Foundation.
Okay. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We are talking about two separate and distinct things. A broker price opinion is not an appraisal, and therefore should not be subject to the standards of an appraisal. Or if it is, then the only people that could do a broker price opinion would have to go through all the training and requirements of an appraiser. And this language specifically in this bill makes that distinction. And so certainly a real estate appraiser is qualified, and you might even say eminently qualified, to do a broker price opinion. But since they are two separate and distinct items, I see no connection between using the USPAP rules or the appraisal rules in a broker price opinion. And yes, members, just for your edification, I do have 20 years experience in real estate brokerage and residential and commercial real estate.
Okay.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Gerlach?
If I can offer up any guidance, I'm somewhat agnostic on this. I'm not certain right now whether or not this is workable or not. The department has said that, in their opinion, that it's not. I'm not positive about that myself. So I will. What I will do is, I'll leave it up to the wisdom of the committee. And if the amendment is not adopted, I would say that I understand the issue that Senator Vandeveer is getting at and would continue to try to find a solution that is workable. If the amendment is adopted and we discover that it is unworkable, then I also will go back to Senator Vandeveer and try to find a solution on this. So this wouldn't be the final word in this particular issue. So I'll leave it up to the wisdom, the committee to determine whether or not that should be part of the bill.
Senator Vandeveer.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gerlach, and I appreciate that. My only comment would be I wonder if this bill is really ready to go, but I could withdraw that amendment and offer a different one that doesn't have the prosecution aspect to it that might make it more amenable. So I'll withdraw the A5 amendment or the A. Which one am I withdrawing?
A8.
And I would like, if I could.
Senator Vandeveer withdraws the A8 amendment.
And then I would offer the A7 amendment.
Senator Vandeveer authors the A7 amendment.
Wait a minute, that's the wrong. Which one did you?
Does everybody have that? A7. Yes. Senator Vandeveer, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerlach, this isn't my amendment, but it's one that was proposed to me as might be more workable and keep the bill from having another stop. So it's as more of a compromise. It's not quite as clear as the other one, but if we were going to move the bill out, I would at least ask that you do that, because I wish Senator Rest was here to talk about this. If we were doing this to CPAs.
Discussion? Senator Bajungbauer?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess this amendment appears to me to be almost more problematic unless the statute is so clear, because it seems pretty broad in saying it shall not be subject to prosecution or enforcement action under state law, including any rule promulgated by state agency or under USPAP. So it almost broadens, way broadens the issue as opposed to the A8 amendment. In my opinion, the A8 amendment seemed workable and maybe needs some fine-tuning. This seems extremely broad.
Discussion? Senator Gerlach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think I agree entirely with Senator Jungbauer. And actually, the A7 amendment was the first attempt to get at Senator Vandeveer's concern. And because it was overbroad in nature and essentially we'd be putting into statute saying that we're not going to prosecute you for something that we're allowing you to do. And so it was kind of odd, but A8 amendment, which was just withdrawn, was actually the second attempt and was closer to actually getting there. So I think that by withdrawing that A8 amendment and then offering up the A7, I think we're moving further away from a solution. So I would urge committee members to reject the A7 amendment and then either put the A8 back on the table for discussion and voting. Or just let the issue ride and let us continue to work on it to the next stage, and that's okay too.
Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I got actually the A8 is my most recent attempt, so gladly withdraw the A7 and would like to offer the A8.
Okay. Senator Vandeveer withdraws the A7 amendment and renews his motion for the A8 amendment. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I'm going to speak in favor of the A8 amendment. And I believe without the A8 amendment, this bill isn't ready to move on to the next committee, because certainly real estate appraisers are qualified to do a BPO. So I urge members to vote in favor of the A8 amendment. And Senator Gerlach has assured us and Commerce, if we can figure out a way to fine-tune it, let's do that in the next committee, but keep the bill moving.
Where is it going to next?
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman, I was wondering if we could get Mr. Eggers' opinion on this amendment.
Thank you very much. Probably need you again here.
Welcome back, Mr. Ecker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Paul Egger with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. Understanding Senator Vandeveer's intent that appraisers are also permitted to do BPOs. We certainly don't have a problem with the intent of the amendment. I guess we'd be willing to work with Senator Gerlach, Department of Commerce, Senator Vandeveer, if the language needs fine-tuning. But I think the first amendment that Senator Vandeveer offered that articulates that appraisers can do BPOs, and this follows up on trying to the language feels like it's trying to add more context or clarity to what that actually means. We certainly don't have a problem with that. We'd be happy to work with the author of the bill, author of the amendment, Department of Commerce, if the language needs fine-tuning or moving forward. So,
Senator Vandeveer, any more discussion? Senator Vandeveer renews his motion on the A8 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The amendment carries or prevails. Okay. Senator Gerlach, back to your bill. Is there any more amendments or discussion?
Mr. Chair, I have
Senator Vandeveer.
I believe I have the A. A6 amendment.
I'm sorry, the A what?
The A6.
Senator Vandeveer moves the A6 amendment.
If we could have Ms. Walker from the appraisal, representing some appraisers, come up, discuss this amendment. And I believe, could she also testify on the bill? Or are we not to that point?
Everybody have the amendment?
Not yet.
Will Ms. Walker Ms. Walker, please come to the testifying table.
Well, thank you. All good. Thank you.
Get clarified.
Senator Vandeveer, do you want to explain this amendment, or you want Ms. Walker to? Or
Mr. Chair, if Ms. Walker could.
Okay. Ms. Walker, state your name for the record.
My name is Wendy Walker. I'm the immediate past president of the local North Star chapter of the Appraisal Institute that includes all of Minnesota, part of Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Canada. Geographically, it's the largest chapter in the country. For the last 3 years, I also served on the Real Estate Appraisal Advisory Board to the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I own my own independent appraisal firm in Minneapolis. And what I would like to say is that BPOs are being increasingly used in place of appraisals, and I think it's extremely important for the committee to look at this from a standpoint of consumer protection. Your home is probably the single largest investment you make in a lifetime. We are going through a period of absolute unprecedented decline in real estate values, and I firmly believe that any loan taken out should have the benefit of a full appraisal rather than a BPO. Nevertheless, I acknowledge that the federal law does not require that, and therefore BPOs have come to be used more and more. My own opinion is that it's penny wise and pound foolish. A BPO is cheaper than an appraisal, but in the end, that's a cost that's passed on to the homeowner. It's not a cost assumed by the lender. So the lender is not saving any real money by doing BPOs rather than appraisals. What they're doing is they are saving the end consumer a few dollars, but that end consumer gets a product that has much less substantiation behind it, is done by an untrained person, and does not have the confidence of value that's supporting the loan that they're getting on their property. I think there's a tremendous difference. For a real estate broker to move to become a trainee real estate appraiser, it requires about 3 weeks of continuing it of education and appraisals and $1,000. That's a minimal entry fee into a profession. I don't know why BPOs are being used in lieu of full appraisals, but recognizing that they are, I just wanted to put that statement out there. I have a letter from a man who is an appraiser. His name is Rich Dubay. He also teaches USPAP classes here, as we said before. USPAP stands for the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice. Rich Dubay had a second mortgage on his home that needed refinancing. He was working with a lender. And was told that typically renewals were made at rates similar to, perhaps slightly above, the original rate. For his loan renewal, they had a BPO done rather than appraisal. This BPO said that it had a two-car garage. It actually has a four-car garage. It said that he had 1,200 square feet of finished area. It's actually about 2,000 square feet. The BPO said it was in average condition. In reality, the home has a new kitchen, a new bathroom, new interior doors and trim, and radiant floor heating in the family room, a gas fireplace, hardwired fire protection. So he thinks the BPO was about $100,000 short. My guess is that the person doing this did it from their desk, and that is how many of these are done. They never even go out and look at the property. It's a quick job. Fill in the form. Send it off to the lender. I want you to understand the difference between a BPO and an appraisal. It is substantial. Is why appraisers cannot do them under USPAP.
Senator Vandiver.
Ms. Walker, could you, maybe Commerce could tell us, I don't like to interrupt, but we're going to be out of time here shortly.
Okay.
And I just want to say, what is the consequences to the person who did that BPO versus an appraiser?
The consequences was that he got, rather than the 5% loan he thought he would, he got an 8.25% loan.
Oh, Mr. Chair and Ms. Walker, I mean, what would happen to an appraiser who made those mistakes versus
an appraiser would probably have their license suspended. That's up to the Commerce investigators, but they would certainly be reprimanded if they had made those mistakes.
And maybe Senator Gerlach, Mr. Chair, Senator Gerlach could tell us what would happen to a real estate agent in the same circumstances who did a BPO and had the same situation, or the author or the Commerce Department could tell us.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vandiver, I couldn't begin to say what would happen as far as enforcement actions.
Okay. Or what options the consumer would have, maybe. Could Commerce come up and tell us?
Well, we're waiting for that. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Gerlach, I guess members, and this does, the whole discussion bothers me unless we get it right, because great points on the difference between an appraisal, as a 25-year builder of homes as well, levels of trim. There's a lot of things that make differences, huge differences, in a normal market. The BPOUs have become more prevalent in the kind of foreclosure market we're dealing with today because people aren't paying that much attention and a value to the different levels of trim or levels of siding or the type of sidewalks or driveways or other things that do make a major difference in value when the market is good, the kind of landscaping, issues like that that a BPOU doesn't deal with. So in today's market, that's all well and good, but we're talking about language that's going into the statute that will survive, hopefully, as we get back into a normal market. So I do want to make sure that we get it right, because there's a significant difference. The other issue is that appraisers do deal with, correct me if I'm wrong, but you'd have errors and omissions insurance to cover when you make a mistake that realtors wouldn't have on a BPOU. So there is a remedy for people that would be aggrieved by the BPOU process versus the appraisal process. So there's major differences here, and we need to make that distinction. and make sure that that occurs within this language.
Mr. Reich, do you want to answer the previous question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, to an extent, a real estate broker does not perform their duties as prescribed by the standards set in state law. The Commerce Department does have the authority to sanction them in a number of ways, civilly, reprimand, revoke their license, and a number of other actions that the Commerce Department can take.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Vandiver first, but to that point, but make sure we're on the A6 amendment.
Oh.
Or A, is it 6? A6 yes. Amendment.
Okay. I'm sorry. If it's to that point, I'll pass.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, on that, then I just wanted to clarify. I'm sorry I was down presenting a bill in another committee, and I think that I just want to be sure I understand the amendment properly. What you're doing is effectively just talking about the refinance. You're adding refinancing. You really are leaving pretty much the language of parens 4, I think, on 131 through 133. It looks like it's duplicated in the amendment. But what you're doing is adding the refi language. Is that right? So that it wouldn't be used for that as well?
Senator Vandiver.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, that is correct.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how much. I lost track of the time I was down there, and I don't know how many amendments you've adopted. But it sounds like we're gone a little astray. First of all, a BPOU, I think, is a Republican term.
BPO.
And I'm embarrassed that I even know that.
I know.
Anyway. I think every time Senator Jungbauer said that. anyway, I mean, having been, thank you, Mr. Chairman, having been a real estate licensee and knowing something about the preparation that I did, and that now, granted, that's a number of years ago, but I think actually the tools are even much improved since I was out there with my long tape measure climbing through shrubs and, you know, under them and over them and measuring houses and doing all of the looking that you're required to do when you're doing a price opinion, that I think that it's clear that there is the regulatory authority on the part of the department for somebody who would do such a thing. I mean, I can't imagine. I don't know if you said that was the person who was the homeowner was an appraiser, but, I mean, as a homeowner, I would certainly be looking at an appraisal. You have the right to do that. You're paying for it and saying, well, you know you have 2,000 square feet instead of 1,200, and you know you have a four-car garage, you know, four stalls or whatever, versus two, I mean, on the face of it, it's not accurate and perhaps complete. So I'm surprised that a lender wouldn't, you know, ask for that to be redone on the basis of the homeowner asking, you know, I mean, pointing those things out. So I think we're into a turf thing here, and I'm not real comfortable with that, but I'd like to hear what the real estate folks have to say about this particular amendment. I'm not sure it does damage. I mean, I can't tell exactly what it does, but it looks to me like it just adds a refi.
Senator Scheid, we have passed a couple of amendments, okay, too, so you're kind of coming in a little bit. But Senator Cruz,
well,
quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and in committee. I am a licensed real estate agent right now. And I guess my interpretation of this amendment, just to speak to the amendment alone, I don't see any concerns with this. I think that a lot of the BPOs that are being done right now in the industry are being done for the purposes of short sales. I think that that's a very convenient thing for the banks to utilize. It helps keep a up-to-date assessment of the property's value, you know, especially in this market right now, as we are still seeing values downtrending as a property stays on the market because there isn't that demand for the property right now. you have to do analysis more often, and that does get costly to the bank. So what we're seeing now is that we are able, because real estate agents are out there able to do these BPOs, that the banks are able to request those every 6 months or so to make sure that they have the most accurate price at a reasonable cost to the bank, which I think is something we need to take into consideration right now because of the financial stability of the banks themselves and just the overall expense of the process. So, I mean, I would say just speaking to this particular amendment, I do not see any issues with that. What I, as far as I understand, what this is saying is if there's a refinance that is going to be refinanced at a cost greater than the current loan, that there would essentially have to be an appraisal done because there is an added risk to that. And I guess myself, I don't see any problems with that. I mean, I guess I would actually, you know, we just passed the amendment that, you know, we were talking about the legally what an appraiser, what we can prosecute an appraiser for. I guess I would have much more concern with that than what we had here. And I would say to this particular one, I wouldn't have a problem.
Senator Gerlach.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me say this, that I would oppose the A6 amendment. And this is the reason why. Currently, there is no federal law saying that you have to use, you know, an appraisal. But it's as a matter of practice, you're foolish if you don't, and lenders do. And if you're going to have a loan that is going to be federally conforming and you want to be able to sell it in the secondary market, they're going to require appraisals in that respect. So as a matter of business practice, they're not required for refinances. Appraisals are not required by federal or state law. If we adopt the A6 amendment, we are creating a new significant, it's a significant policy decision that is beyond the scope of what I'm trying to get at with this bill. Currently today, there is no regulatory structure around BPOs. I'm trying to put that in place here, but this is a significant, the idea of requirements when it's not required currently is a significant expansion of the scope of the bill, of which I'm not prepared to deal with today when we're over time. So I would urge members to reject the A6 amendment today. It doesn't mean that down the road we can't always address these policy decisions or these questions, but today I would like to reject the A6 amendment.
To that point.
And Senator Vanderveer, to that point.
The bill just says that you cannot use a BPO as a valuation method the amendment says if you increase the principal of the loan. It is not a new requirement that an appraisal be required to refinance a loan. If you are using a valuation technique, you could not use a BPO, is what it says, if you're increasing the principal. So that's a correction, Mr.
Chairman. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thank you very much for that. I was not aware. I was under the impression when I made my previous comments that was already in place and that we were conforming. With that being said, I agree with the author of the bill.
Ms. Walker, is that right?
Thank you. I would like to make two comments. First, I think that the state of Minnesota really has a role to play in consumer protection, in making sure that people are getting the best advice they can when they're refinancing a property. I would like to read you language that was passed by the House of Representatives in the state of Mississippi that is much stricter than this, and they agreed to it with the support of the realtors in Mississippi. It says that a BPO cannot be used as the determination of the value of a parcel of real property for a mortgage loan transaction, including but not limited to mortgage loan origination, refinance, equity line of credit, or second mortgage. That is more comprehensive. Mississippi is taking better care of their residents than the state of Minnesota is. And I also would like to add a comment for Senator Jungbauer, in that when we initially met with the brokers, we had a requirement in here that asked them to have a certification that the broker is covered by errors and omissions insurance that provides adequate coverage for all liability associated with the preparation of the broker's price opinion. They would not agree to that. I would strongly recommend that be included in the bill.
further discussion?
I think we have the A6 amendment before us, Mr.
All right.
Chairman.
Senator Vandeveer, I don't know if you're supposed to say this, renews his motion for the A6 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chairman, we're on the bill. I don't know if there's any further amendments.
Are there any further amendments? Discussion?
The bill.
Seeing none.
I have discussion to the bill.
Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, what you're doing is you're substantially lowering the standards, and I think that the Commerce Department will agree, because I could ask them back up here and say, what standard would you apply to that BPO when you were doing your disciplinary action? Where is the standards? And there is no set of standards. But for that BPO that says you have to measure accurately, there is no group, there is no ethical oversight on them. So yes, the Commerce Department could come in and do something based on the license, but what standards are you, would you use specifically would be the question, and who writes and updates those standards. But secondly, really what you're doing here is you are substantially lowering the credibility of collateral evaluations for loans that will be guaranteed by the federal government and in the end by us. Because whatever bank makes these loans and is using these, you are saying it's okay to use an inferior product. And that is, at this point in time, is an absolutely absurd thing to do. Because why would you lower the standards and cause the taxpayers to be further at risk? So with that, I want to be clear that I don't support this. It's not to catch you guys. And I would ask for a roll call so that people know where I stand on the issue.
A roll call has been requested. Senator Cruz?
Just to speak to the bill, real estate agents are trained. They're heavily regulated. An overwhelming majority are a member of a trade association with a very, very strict code of ethics that are enforced. So I would say we have multiple areas where we're restricted. I think that what you see with a real estate agent is somebody who is boots on the ground, actually understands what a property is going to sell for, and is very capable because they have the use of systems like the MLS to do these for banks. And I would urge a yes vote.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I might ask a fundamental question that if I had been here earlier, I'm sure I would know the answer to it. And I'm looking at the definition of broker price opinion. I don't know if you adopted that one amendment. It included appraisers
yes.
in that. But is there a statutory definition, I don't think in this bill, of an appraisal and how that differs? And I'm assuming there is some difference. And so this is strictly, I mean, I'm getting nods that indicate there is some language statutorily that defines appraisal, and it seems to me it's probably different than a BPO, and this is an estimate detailing the probable selling price. I mean, that's to me distinctly different than what I would consider an appraisal to be. So I'm not sure I understand the angst of people who are opposing this, but it seems to me that this is reasonable and not above and beyond what real estate salespersons, brokers do every day.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gerlach.
I know we're over time and we want to get to a vote on this, but the Minnesota Bankers Association wanted to offer up some statements based on some things that were said here today to make sure that things are understood correctly. So if we could have somebody, they wanted to just take a moment.
Good afternoon. Now, state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Tess Rice, General Counsel and Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Bankers Association. The point I wanted to clarify is when lenders can have to use full appraisals. Refis are not exempt from appraisals. Anytime an appraisal is not required, which might be a refi with the same lender where there's no new money going out, an evaluation still has to be done. The regulators require more than a broker price opinion. In fact, they've said specifically that broker price opinions are not an evaluation. It's not sufficient. So when we're talking about refis, home equity lines, any kind of second mortgage that is exempt from appraisal requirements, they still have to have a full evaluation done, and a broker price opinion is not sufficient for that.
Thank you. Senator Gerlach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just conclude with I think this is a good bill. I think that it offers some guidance to the Department of Commerce that whereas when complaints would come in, it was a gray area. They didn't know. This bill provides a regulatory framework to help regulators, our state regulators, to do their enforcement duties. Now it's concrete. I think that it strengthens our consumer protection laws, not weakens them. It clarifies it. It gives some tools to the Department of Commerce. And based on that, and it's not perfect. The entire industry is constantly in flux. We know that. But this is an attempt right now to take a stab at putting that regulatory framework around that to referee some of those disputes or turf battles. And we'll run this through. We'll see if this works in the industry. And if not, we can make those adjustments in the future. But I think this is a good work product comprised of a lot of different sources. We have taken a lot of ideas from the appraisers, not all of them, but a lot of them, and I would urge your support for this bill.
Thank you. Senator Gerlach has moved that Senate File 167, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. The Secretary shall take the roll.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yes.
Senator Dames.
Yes.
Senator Gazelka.
Yes.
Chairman Gerlach.
Yes.
Senator Cruz.
Yes.
Senator Reinert.
Yes.
Senator Scheid.
Yes.
Senator Sparks.
Yes.
Senator Vanderveer.
No.
There being 8 ayes and 1 nay, the bill as amended has passed. Amended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. Thank you.
And you can adjourn the committee.
And we are adjourned as well.